Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guests today are Clark Strand and Perdita Finn. They're co-founders of The Way of the Rose, an inclusive fellowship of friends dedicated to the earth and to the lady, quote, by any name we wish to call her, end quote. Strand is the author of numerous books and articles on spiritual practices, including Seeds from the Birch Tree, Writing Haiku and the Spiritual Journey, and Waking Up to the Dark, Ancient Wisdom for a Sleepless Age. Finn is a former public high school teacher who designed the curriculum for the Urban Peace Academy in New York City and has written numerous books for teachers and children. They live with their family in the Catskill Mountains. So first off, thank you for all your great work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek, so much.
Happy to be here.
So you recently have written a book called The Way of the Rose, and I want to read my blurb for it. And I'm gonna give a secret to people that I'm sure you know too, that maybe a lot of listeners don't, which is most of us writers get really tired of being asked for blurbs. But I have to say, honestly, that I was honored and loved giving your book a blurb. It was not a chore at all.
That means a lot.
And also, I meant every word I said. and we know that sometimes blurbs are a little bit ad copy. I'll stop spilling industry secrets now. Okay. Ultimately, The Way of the Rose is a love song to the world and to the mysteries of the world. Moving and profound, powerful and elegant, it is a call for us to remember our place in the larger community of humans past, present, and future, and our place in the larger community of life on this planet. I love this book. So what is The Way of the Rose?
Well, roses are 35 million years old. They've been around a really, really long time. And as long as human beings have been around, they've been devoted to roses. And it's a kind of evolutionary love story. There's every evidence, and Clark can go into this at more length, that part of becoming a human being is about our relationship to roses. And we've honored that and expressed that the roses, as far back as we know, were what we offered to the earth and to the goddess in gratitude. They were sacred. It's not entirely clear why. There's some theory. Is it because they're five petals or like the five fingers of the human hand? Or is it, as Clark has often said, that roses sort of taught it what it was, what it meant to fall in love, to fall in love with the earth just for the sheer beauty of it?
Mm. Yeah, there really isn't any explanation for why human beings became devoted to the rose initially above all other flowers, so that they were really the first cultivated flowers. You know, the reason why we grew gardens exclusively devoted to roses, or to explain the reason why roses figure so prominently in our spiritual literature and our romantic literature. There seems to be something about them that really touched the human heart. And one of the things we wrote about in Way of the Rose was this idea that, in a certain way, if human beings loved roses, it's possible that roses taught human beings what love was, what beauty was. So it's a very, very old evolutionary dance that's been going on between human beings and this flower.
And one of the oldest spiritual rituals was to create rose garlands. As an offering to the goddess, to the great mother. That was what people did to express their love of the earth. And those rose garlands became also prayer practices and spiritual practices. But in the beginning, it was just sort of offering back those flowers in gratitude.
Yeah, it was a circle of flowers woven in the springtime and season. As an offering, and probably early human beings crowned one another with these roses. And then as people became sedentary and began to live together in cities, they built temples and life-size statues to the Great Mother. And at that point, they began to offer these flowers to the Great Mother. And there's some thought that the circular shape, both of the rosary itself, the circle of beads, and of these flowers, is itself a kind of encoded message about the planetary ecology and the fact that life goes in circles and not in lines.
So if the Way of the Rose is what it is it's a path of devotion to the earth. And our ancestors were devoted to the earth. And what does that look like again? What does it mean to love her, to listen to her, to know that we're her children?
So I'm thinking a few things. One of them is that you saying all this has sparked a memory that I'd forgotten about for decades, which is a good friend of mine and I at a good friend of mine introduced me to weaving flower bracelets when I was like 19. Mm-hmm. And I just remembered that was a very touching moment of a person making a flower bracelet for me. So that's one memory or one thing. And the next thing, and you can take any of these anywhere you want. The next thing is you mentioned the goddess. And in the introduction, we talked about the lady by any name we wish to call her. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that. And the third is you mentioned rosary beads. And is it a coincidence that rosary beads and rose, is that some sort of linguistic coincidence that those have the same three letters?
Well, it's no coincidence at all. The word rosary means rose garland. Okay, so the and actually the circle of beads was a way of reenacting through a prayer ritual this older ritual of offering a circlet of flowers, usually roses, to the goddess. And that tradition, you know, goes back thousands of years before. The rose was Mary's flower. It was Isis's flower. And before Isis, you know, Inanna, Aphrodite, all of these, nearly all of these great mothers of the Mediterranean and South Central Europe were, you know, were honored with these garlands of roses. Eventually, this ancient devotion had the Christian ritual sort of grafted onto it, right? So the rosary, the Catholic rosary, became basically a kind of what does Sophie always say?
It's like a stowaway,
like a stowaway inside the hull of the Catholic Church, sort of passed down through the centuries. This devotion to the Mother Goddess that was passed down within the rituals of the Church.
And that Mother Goddess is, if you go back, you know, 20,000-30,000 years in the record, you find these Paleolithic goddess figurines. There are no male figurines. There are only female figurines. And one of the things that's really interesting about them is they come in all shapes and sizes. It's tremendous diversity of them, except they're all would fit in your hand. And they're not meant for standing up. They're meant to be held. They're very clearly were sort of talismanic. There was a way of holding the mother in your hand and knowing that you felt held. You know, one of the things is sort of this kind of modern idea that we're supposed to let go of everything. And I always think that sort of something sort of awful about it, like we can let go of everything, including the earth. And in fact, as apes, as primates, our first instinct isn't to let go, it's to hold on. And that's the first thing we do is we hold on to our mothers when we're born. And it's that instinct that keeps us alive. And it's that instinct that makes us feel better is holding on. And knowing the right things to hold on to can help us let go of the wrong things.
Yeah. And you know, the rosary itself is, you know, offers us a way back to that sort of umbilical attachment to the earth and to the Great Mother. And so the beads are a very tactile practice. You find, you know, prayer beads in virtually every tradition around the world. And beads themselves are, you know, what, 70,000, 100,000 years old.
They found beads 100,000 years old in Morocco. And it's very labor intensive to make beads. I mean, we can go off on 1,000 tangents, Turk, so you'll have to butt in at some point.
Oh, I'm so happy with everything you're saying. And now that you've asked me to butt in, I'm going to retroactively butt in a second ago. Okay. And say and ask you to repeat the thing you said about not letting go but holding tight. And the reason is because I have had so many people who were smarmily spiritual.
Yes.
tell me that I need to learn the Buddhist practice of non-attachment because I am so dearly attached to salmon. Oh. And it makes me want to scream.
All right, Derek, please let me do that. All right. First of all, you know, I always say I'm an equal opportunity hater when it comes to patriarchal religious experience. And And Buddhism is just as much a patriarchal an institution as any, you know, the Abrahamic faith. And, you know, Buddhism was founded on somebody being so freaked out about his wife having a baby that he had to abandon, this is true, yeah. that he had to abandon her on the night that she's giving birth to his child to go off and live like a forest ascetic.
And he named his child Rahula, which means hindrance.
So he let go, I mean, and
that kid has many years of therapy ahead.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally. And I think this idea, there's a lot of this kind of letting go, you know, oh, you know, the earth will figure it out. We don't have to worry about it so much. And that's not true. We have to learn how to be attached to each other again yeah. and interconnected again
yeah.
and how to hold on to what we love
yeah.
and how to feel held on. I think there's actually a lot of fear underlying those people who say those things, who are terribly frightened and terribly alone. Mm. And, you know, they haven't.
I've got a joke for you, Derek, that you probably know now because you've read the book, but you know, most people haven't heard it. I heard it for the first time in fourth grade, and maybe some of your listeners will have heard it. You know, at the end of his life, the prophet Moses asks a final favor of God, and God agrees to grant it because Moses has been his faithful servant. Moses says to God, "I would like to have my belly button removed." God says, "Well, I could do that, but you know, of course, that I created everything in the world for a reason, even belly buttons." And Moses said, "Yeah, yeah, I know, but even so, I would like to have my belly button removed." And so God has Moses stripped naked as the day he was born and lie atop Mount Sinai. And soon a giant cloud in the shape of a screwdriver comes down and unscrews Moses' belly button. He stands up and his butt falls off.
But
so like every fourth grader on the playground loved this joke so much that, you know, it just went like wildfire throughout the whole school. But, you know, this is a joke about attachment. Moses wants his belly button removed. You know, Siddhartha Gautama wants to escape from the wheel of birth and death. It's like people believe that they can escape from a planetary ecology, like as if that were the point of human existence, to transcend the body. And that simply isn't the point.
But I think also what people are trying to do, Derek, is they're trying to escape pain. And as we all know, that when you really love hard, whether it's salmon or bears or your mother or anyone, it involves tremendous pain because people do die and people do suffer. And so to be able to love is to be able to bear terrible pain and suffering. And what happens, though, if we stop trying to escape that? And I think that's one of the questions I really have is how do we begin to give people the courage, something to hold on to that will give them the courage to bear the pain that we're seeing in the world yeah. right now and to bear witness to it. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things I'm so struck by that you're able to do. You can look at what's really happening in the world with tremendous courage. And my question for you would be, what gives you that courage?
Now, what is it that you hold on to that allows you to do that? Because you have to have something to hold on to be able to face truths on that scale.
I think, well, the glib answer is that my mom raised me right. And
yeah,
exactly.
The deeper answer, I think, this is something... I wasn't really planning on going here today, but I think it works that I've been really struggling lately because of, you know, my mom died a couple years ago. And I think I wonder whether it's in a relationship, a romantic relationship, a parent relationship, a child relationship, you know. Where do we find the solidity in our lives, and where do we find that thing we can cling to? And it can't be another mm-hmm. human, because the other human's going to die. And
yeah.
what can provide the solidity, the stability? And something I've mentioned before is that I read a book by Charles Frazier, who wrote Cold Mountain, a book called 13 Moons.
Oh, I love that book.
Yeah, and I there were two love stories in it for the listeners. One love story between the man and the woman, which I thought was okay. And then the love story between the protagonist and the land, which I thought was fantastic. Yeah. And at the end of the book, he's an old man. He has this wonderful speech about how, wonderful heartbreaking speech about how, you know, you lose lovers, you lose your children, you lose your parents, and that's evolutionarily what's supposed to happen, because we all die and you lose your faculties.
Right.
But what we aren't supposed to lose is the land.
Yeah.
And the book is set between 1820 and 1900, and at the beginning there are wolves, and at the end there are railroad cars. And and I just, you know, you ask where I get the strength to look at it. Some of it, when my mom was alive, was from my mom, and some of it is from the land. But even that is hard, because the land, you know, the land was supposed to abide, and it doesn't now because it is so grievously injured. And so I'm going to turn this back around, and thank you for asking that wonderful question. And what is your answer to that, both for yourselves and for humanity in general?
Well, the first word that came to my mind when you were talking, even before you brought up 13 moons, was the dirt. You know, I when you talk about the land, it's really visceral. I mean, it's that feeling, the solidity of the dirt beneath my feet, and knowing that when I pick it up, I'm holding the dead in my hand.
Yeah.
I mean, the dirt is nothing but the dead. It's the dead animals, it's the dead trees, it's the dead stones and the dead mountains. We're going to become dirt. And I think it's feeling like anything goes anywhere, that we're supposed to leave that. I mean, we're not supposed to. Nobody goes anywhere. We're all here. But I'm with you. I feel this agony. I mean, I feel a kind of daily agony about what's happening. And being done to the body of the land, from the trees to this weird season, it seems like all the birds have vanished from our land. So I feel it in the darkness, in the dirt, in the dead. Some people, you know, have called that the Black Madonna, these images, these, you know, this idea that Isis was the land and the soil, the black delta soil itself, and that people understood and those goddess figurines, what they were sculpting was, they saw in the land were women's bodies. They saw their mother. They saw the mountains. They saw the valleys. That was this, the land held them just the same way their mothers held them. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
and they would climb into these, deep into these caves in order to paint animals within them, as if they were, you know, impregnating the earth or participating in that process of recreation.
Yeah, collaborating.
Collaborating with the mother in order to bring these animals to life.
And I often think about, you know, how do you want me to collaborate with you? And I think it's also, for me, it's not an abstract idea. It's not an abstraction that keeps me stuck in my head. It feels very literal. I mean, I feel frequently comforted by all of the expressions of the land, from the animals and the owls. I mean, I'm so struck by how generous the land is, from the plants that grow to offer to heal us on our property. I mean, you know, people in our neck of the world are panic-stricken about Lyme disease, and yet everywhere Japanese knotweed is growing and offering them the healing medicine they need. And and there is, but I do want to know how I'm supposed to collaborate and help.
You know, Derek, one of the simplest ways I have of talking to people about the rosary, because, you know, people hear that we pray the rosary, they assume we're Catholic. We're not, you know, we don't have any religious affiliation or any religious beliefs at all, but we do believe in the Lady. And we believe that, you know, this ancient ritual, this symbol, you know, traces its origin all the way back to devotion to the earth and the Great Mother. But one of the simplest ways I have of explaining what I'm doing when I pray the rosary to people is I say the rosary is a prayer for the earth to win. Yeah, because if the earth doesn't win, we've lost. There's no way for us to win. For us, winning is losing as a species. I mean, you've written, you know, extensively about this, and I think actually it was through your books that I first encountered that idea. You know, that really took for me. It took a long time to sort of think my way through it, because I'm a person who reads a lot of spiritual texts. You know, I think after I read Endgame for the first time, I immediately sort of went back to formula with all the religious texts I'd read. And if I couldn't find some ecological truth in what I was reading, I pretty much abandoned it, you know. And I had a few texts after, you know, this whole process was over that I felt like had real ecological sanity in them. The Book of Job, the Song of Songs in the Western canon, a few surahs from the Quran, the Lotus Sutra. There were places where you could find that wisdom. So we finally evolved, you know, a kind of a slogan for ourselves, ecology, not theology, right? If you want to find spiritual sanity, you have to turn to ecology. You can't get lost in the sky.
I want to read you something that Lear Keith wrote, because it made me think of it when you were talking about the all the figurines that are made. And I love this line. For 2.5 million years, some version of us has lived on this planet, and we weren't monsters and destroyers. Our brains got bigger, our tools got better, letting our brains get bigger still. We didn't make war, we made art. Specifically, we rendered the megafauna.
Yeah.
And the mega females.
Yeah.
Sec. Because that was who gave us life. The moment our brains got big enough to know that, we said thank you. That was the beginning of religion.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, you were talking, we were just before the interview began, about the difference between culture and civilization. And I think back on those people who had, you know, they had art, they had music, they made incredibly exquisite flutes, they experienced themselves as wildly creative, and
they painted. But they, you know, if you go into some of those caves, like in the Dordogne and the other Altamira, all these various different regions throughout Central Europe, where they painted these wonderful, wonderful paintings, you're not going to find many images of human beings, in fact, almost none. And the ones you find are just like stick figures. They did not render in their portraiture of themselves anything like the anatomical precision of the portraits they made of the animals. I mean, they were devoted to these creatures. Like, and they weren't just the creatures that they hunted. In fact, oftentimes not. But the spirit and the beauty of these creatures was deeply moving to them. It's how they related to the beauty of the world.
I had this experience, and there's no way to prove it, when we were in the caves, that I felt like these people knew we were going to screw things up. I felt like they were leaving us a reminder. Like, what was it like to be in a world filled with this much diversity? And I just think of, I mean, there's this one cave painting I love more than anything. It's a red deer is licking the forehead of another deer. And it's the gentlest, sweetest, most beautiful thing. And you realize it's people, they were seeing and watching and participating. And we've lost it, you know?
So I'm going to go, thank you for that. I'm going to go a different direction now. I want to talk about beads for a second.
And absolutely.
Can you talk about the relationship between tactility? What's the word? Tactile. Mm-hmm. About feeling something physical, repetitive motion, devotion, and sacrality.
Absolutely. I'll tell you something I've been talking about with people. I didn't put it in the book, but people have been making beads for 100,000 years, and it's really hard to make beads. It takes a lot of effort and time to carve them, to get them right. But it mattered to people to take that time and effort. And the question is, why? Why have we been making beads for 100,000 years? They found them, you know, 70,000 years ago in Africa, and what was going on? And if you hold a bead between your fingers, your thumb and your forefinger, and you just roll it between your fingers, it feels quite pleasurable. It's a very nice feeling. It's a very calming feeling. We call it fidgeting. You know, people have these fidget spinners today to try to help themselves calm down. But beads were kind of the original fidget spinner. And if you look at a bead and you hold it between your finger, you realize that gesture is our first gesture when we're born, because the first thing we hold on to is our mother's nipple. I mean, I'm a mother, I've had two kids, and the first thing they do is they came out and they grabbed hold and they started to eat. And it's an, you know, it's a wonderful moment, you know, this is going to work. And it's their consolation, their nourishment, their sweetness. So the making of beads is that reminder that there is nourishment in the world, there is love, and there is consolation, and we're being held by something much bigger than us. On a
and
more
fed.
And a more practical level, that gesture of moving beads between fingers most likely comes from the gathering activities, the gathering of seeds and nuts and berries. You know, if you, I was pulling Brussels sprouts off a stalk recently, and it's that same satisfying gesture. Or if you've ever gone berry picking, that, you know, hand over hand feeling of pulling the bead, the berries off the branch is the same as like running a string of beads through your fingers. And it's a very, the gathering practices of indigenous peoples is primarily where their calories come from. And instead of the kind of silent spiritual practices that we privilege in the right now in modern culture, these practices involved a tremendous amount of communal sharing, storytelling, singing, children could be cared for, old people taken care of, a lot of chit-chat.
Right.
And they weren't, we've privileged, our religions privileged silence as a way of silencing people a lot of times, particularly women. And a lot of the meditative behaviors come from hunting and that kind of the need to be still, the need to be quiet, focused, alert, which is fine if you're hunting, but if all the world is hunting and nobody's gathering anymore, things get complicated.
Mm. You know, also you mentioned repetitive prayer, and beads, of course, the world over are used basically to recite mantras. The rosary, you know, has a number of different prayers, but its central prayer, the prayer that's repeated back to back over and over again, is the Hail Mary, which is basically a mantra. And the experience of mantric prayer, it's soothing, it's calming, it's centering. But it's something even more primal than that, I think. I read a few years ago a book by a man named Fritz Stahl, who was one of the, at the time of his death, was one of the foremost Indologists in the world. He was an expert in the Vedas. And his theory about mantra was that it was older even than human language. You talk in your book about a language older than words, right? That was your first book. Am I right? I think so.
It's my first big book.
Yeah. And Fritz Stahl believed that mantra was a language older than words, and he compared mantric utterances to bird calls, and in their musicality and in their precision. You know, a friend of mine taught me the Hail Mary in Latin, the Ave Maria. And I started saying it on my night walks. I've long had a habit of getting up in the middle of the night after my first sleep and walking for an hour, usually from about 2 to 3 a.m. And for years now, I've been saying the rosary out loud on these walks. But just recently, this friend taught me how to say the Hail Mary in Latin. So I've been chanting it in Gregorian chant. And I've noticed that the animals behave in a very different way towards me. I mean, the animals are always there. I see bears, coyotes, you know, foxes, raccoons, you know, you name it. But the owls especially. We have a little shrine to Our Lady of Woodstock out near, on the road near our house, and I'll frequently stop there at the end of the night. And recently, when I go there, I'm still singing the Hail Mary in Latin, and the owls have started coming into the area of just next to the shrine and perching above the shrine, and they'll sit there and listen to me singing. And when I stop, they'll go, hoo-hoo, hoo-hoo, right? And I'll start up again, and then they'll start their singing. So I've been wondering lately, like, what is that about? And I think, you know, to the animals, we have all kinds of sounds. We're very noisy creatures, but it's like chaos. It must sound so incoherent to them. But when we have something that we say over and over again like that, it's like a bird call. It's like our sound. So I imagine the owl saying, gosh, I didn't know you were an animal, right? I didn't know you were an animal. Now I understand you're one of us, right? You have a call after all, right?
I'm thinking of... there are some times when humans singing together collectively can... well, the first time I ever heard Beethoven's Ninth was not until I was in my 30s, believe it or not. Yeah. And I listened to it over and over one afternoon and couldn't stop sobbing.
Oh, wow. Oh,
yeah.
And there is something about the repetitive... I'm just going to throw some blob out there, and you can both take it and do whatever, do your magic with it. Which is, there is something. I'm just responding to this notion of chanting. That chanting and singing are, of course, closely related.
Yeah.
Mm. And there is something about it that, I know what I'm trying to get at. So years ago, my friend Jeanette Armstrong, who's an Okanagan Indian writer and activist, she talked about how she was going to go somewhere to help a person who was recovering from leaving her abusive husband. Mm. And she said one of the things that they were going to do were some specific chants, and they knew tonally and repetitively how to access parts of her psyche such that they could accomplish in a weekend what might take 10 years in therapy.
That's completely in line with what I've been reading about somatic therapy. Completely.
So go ahead. Just I'm done now. Just take that and I mean, there is something about music that I mean, as much as your writing is so powerful, and as much as I don't know, Aldo Leopold's writing is so powerful, or Rachel Carson's writing is so powerful, there is something about music. Oh, I want to go a bad direction too, and then I'm going to shut up. Which is, I was listening to this interview with a rock star, and he was saying how fun it was to go to Mongolia or someplace where they've never heard Western music, play some power chords, and have teenagers respond to the chords viscerally. And then that horrified me, because of course a lot of rock and roll music has pretty nasty messages a lot of times.
Right.
So what they're doing is they're opening them up with this visceral, this, okay, I'm done. Go ahead. Take it.
Well, you know, one of the things I'm thinking about is magic. You know, what's the difference between mantra and prayer and spells? Nothing. You know, that we used to understand that, like, these repetitive words were spells, and they can be really powerful and create real goodness and real healing within us. Mm. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, they can also be bad. You know, we can be awful spells, be awful repetitive things we say to ourselves, leftovers from our childhoods and our culture that we tell ourselves that are bad. Mm. And how do we replace that with better spells?
Yeah. I do think, Derek, also that chant probably was, you know, probably one of the earliest forms of culture that human beings had. And it allowed them to come together and, you know, through rhythm and through vocalization and drumming, probably flute playing, they were able to experience a communion with one another and a fellowship with one another that, you know, that created a kind of a tribal solidarity. I think that there was something very wholesome about that, and I think that gets reenacted when we do certain kinds of mantric or chanting rituals together, or kirtan. But eventually what happened was, you know, that power became harnessed by agricultural civilization, you know, to create what Daniel Lord Smale, a historian, called psychotropic mechanisms, which is basically where people begin to respond en masse emotionally to these rituals and these symbols. They become ways of manipulating large-scale populations. Yeah, even the presidential debates, you know, like, you know, include all kinds of these psychotropic mechanisms. You know, we can't begin to feel ourselves emotionally manipulated.
I'm with what both of you have just said. I'm kind of stunned here, just now looking at music as spells.
Yeah.
And I that's why I wanted to bring it back to that. I think that's really important for to sort of pop into people's heads and then they can say, oh, that's crap, and then 5 years later they'll be spewing it themselves because they at least that's what I do.
Yeah. Me too. I do the same thing, and then I'm embarrassed.
So we have like 15 minutes left. We're still in great shape, but I wanted to try to start, because I think this might be a long process. I want to try to start to bring everything together. And what I want to do is I want to read the titles of the parts of your book, The Way of the Rose, and then if you could move people through this movement of the book. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yep.
So part one, well, there's the Pathway of the Rosary, Pathway to the Rosary, sorry. Part one is The Lady in the Garden. Part two is The Heart's Desire. Part three is The Fellowship of the Rose. Part four is The Valley of Tears. Part five is The Queen of Heaven and Earth. So can you move people through that process that you that you go through in the book?
Sure. It's a five. The book is arranged in five parts, like the five-petaled rose. The original roses are five-petaled. And so the first part of the book is about the mother, the great mother, you know, our experience of her in history, historically, in deep time, and about what it means to reclaim that relationship to the earth as our mother, not as an idea, an abstraction, not some Gaia theory, but as a really lived experience of intimacy and conversation.
Well, I wouldn't say it's, you know, it doesn't violate the terms of the Gaia theory, but it makes it real. You know, it's not a, you know, it's not
it's
just
who,
an
not what, as sometimes Clark says.
Yeah, it's, we have this way, I think, of speaking about the planetary ecology that's purely functional and doesn't have any real emotional valence. And our remote ancestors experienced the Earth as a who, not as a what. Wasn't a commodity, wasn't a resource. You know, the earth was a mother, and the relationship to it was to the earth was as a loving, sustaining, consoling presence. And we try to evoke that and to bring people back into relationship with that earth as mother in that first part of the book.
Something that I find really interesting is that Peggy Reeve Sande did a cross-cultural study of high and low rape cultures and the characteristics of high rape cultures. And one of the things I found most fascinating about it was that generally high rape cultures have a male creator deity as opposed to a couple or a female.
Yeah. Yep.
And I first learned that from Judith Herman, and she had this great sort of aside. She said, and you know, it is pretty counterintuitive to think of a male creator deity. And it just, that line makes me laugh because it is. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, you don't start having male deities until you have agriculture.
Right.
Until you're actually trying to control the body of the land and force it into fertility.
Right.
And you don't have rape until you have that kind of experience. You start raping. I mean, you start raping the land and then you start controlling the bodies of women. And, you know, I mean, I often say, you know, I often ask people, you know, yes, I'm all for a right to choose, but how about the earth gets to make the choices about her own body, too? Are you ready to give her the right to choose what she does with the body?
The rights of women and the rights of the earth are one. And I think when you have religious traditions that from the get-go deprive women of their rights, and then it's inevitable that that the earth becomes despoiled as well. Although I'm not sure which came first. I suspect that, you know, once we began practicing agriculture, as Perdita suggested, and, you know, driving the land into a state of forced fertility and monotony, you know, it was only a matter of time before we began to do that with women. What we did with the body of the earth, we did with women's bodies.
So I interrupted you. You were talking about The Lady in the Garden.
So we get to the mother, and you know, this book has a, you know, the second part of the book is The Heart's Desire, which has the fundamental question, which is, what do we want? And that's actually, we've discovered, a really, really radical question. You know, what is your heart's desire? Is your heart's desire for, you know, humans to win or for the earth to win?
Right.
And when we know what we want, when we really know what gives us joy, we suddenly become able to resist the culture in a completely right. different way.
If we don't know what we what our heart's desires are, the culture will tell us what to desire. And the culture doesn't really, I think, want us to know our heart's desire or even to reach for it, because the once we do that, once we find what is truly satisfying, you know, it turns out not to be an endless array of products, right? Or, you know, or an endless parade of novelty. It turns out to be the very basic elements of culture that nurtured our ancestors, you know, music, love, food, good food, good
touch,
good relations, art, you know, the things that music, things that bring us real joy. The culture doesn't wants to commodify those things if it allows us to have them at all. And it wants to put a price tag on them. Most of the things that make us truly joyous as human beings, you know, don't come with a big price tag.
But it's become really radical. You know, you ask, particularly when you ask women, what do you want? It's a terrifying question. We've been really trained out of asking that question. I mean, yeah. They think it's going to be bad or, you know, I'm not allowed to want things, but it's, you know, but when people begin to say, well, I want to be healed, suddenly they begin to claim their own healing, and then they become really capable of bringing it to other people.
Mm-hmm. There was a,
and they're right.
There was a French literary theorist named René Girard who talked about mimetic desire, the idea that we learn what to desire from other people, from basically from civilization. And, you know, so we are taught to desire things like money, for instance, as a thing in itself, you know, that don't really bring us any joy or any happiness or any security in and of themselves. So to ask ourselves what is our heart's desire and to really reach inside and to see what it is that will truly bring us joy and a feeling of belonging and safety, you know, that is a, in our culture today, a very countercultural, counterintuitive strategy for personal happiness.
I'm thinking of the line by R.D. Lang, how do you plug a void plugging a void?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so painful to think, you know, if I find myself in an argument with someone, I say, what do you want right now? You know, if we've been to ask people what they want, it's very disarming. And what do you want for the earth right now? What do you want to look out at fields of solar panels? Does that give you joy? You know?
We had a friend, a very talented person in the publishing industry who lost her job. She called us the night it happened, you know, right at the peak of her career. And Perdita said, listen to about 5 minutes of this, you know, just terrible story. And Perdita said, what do you want? And there was this sort of dead silence on the other end of the line. And finally she said, I want to go to Paris with my husband. This is a person who just worked, you know, like 80 or 90 hours a week for years to like succeed in the publishing industry, right? And she said, I really just want to go to Paris with my husband.
And I said, so your prayers have been answered. Just go.
Well, we got an email. We got an email from her. We're working on a project together. So we had an email exchange for the next the next week, and she said basically like, well, I have to get back to you later in the day. We're at the Louvre.
But, you know, it turns out, you know, we've asked people a lot of things. What do people want? They want love. They want healing. They don't want any of this culture. People don't want it.
So let's move on to the Fellowship of the Rose. We have about 7 or 8 minutes left.
So we'll move fast. One of the things I think we're really longing for are friends. You know, what does it mean to have a circle of friends? So much of modern life, and one of the things Clark and I have been fascinated for years about, we sort of were constantly trying to find a place in some spiritual community where we would eventually, in our anti-authoritarian way, get into trouble.
Yeah.
And what does it look like to be able just to have a circle of friends that allow children and animals and old people and young people to all be together and to be able to share that journey for the heart's desire and to not need teachers and masters and gurus and experts and priests, but to just be able to sit with other people and share and sing together.
And tell stories
yeah. and share spells for the healing of the earth.
And sit in circles rather than in pews, right? I mean, you know, we asked ourselves, you know, what most religious cultures around the world had in common. You know, like what were the problems that they ran into? And the two things we came up with is that they ran into problems with conversation and with women. Sometimes they suppressed conversation, sometimes they suppressed women, and usually it was both. So what we discovered was by sitting in a circle at our rosary meetings and just telling our stories to one another and then, you know, practicing basically chant mantra music together and praying for our heart's desire, that we were able to get into intimate connection through spiritual friendship with other people. We didn't need any experts. We didn't need any. No one had to be in charge. We didn't need any money even. All we needed was one another.
No priests, no property, or no priestesses either. You know, just friends. And that's really a radical. I mean, that's not radical to indigenous communities at all, but as, you know, modern Western people, it's quite radical. Yeah. And finally, I think, you know, the fourth section of our book is this Valley of Tears, which brings us back to this idea to really look at what's happening in the world and to have the courage to
really see it.
To really see it and not turn away and not veer off into some hopium that's going to, or bliss in any state that's going to keep us from really, really confronting the horror of what we've done. I say the Hail Mary prayer, and for me it's a prayer to the triple goddess, the maiden, the mother, and the crone. And I use the word sinners in it. And some people say, oh, I can't. They grew up in, you know, fundamentalist religious households, and that word sinners has been used against them with violence, and they don't want to use it. For me, I'm a Homo sapien, and my species has committed a lot of sin. And I need to really take responsibility for that and find the courage to really bear witness to it.
Yeah.
And to really see it so that we can, you know, begin to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And begin to find out what it is we need to do to make amends and to atone for our mistakes. And that I feel really, really strongly about. I mean, I come back to the fact, Derek, that I don't know anyone who does that with more power than you. And it's why I'm always handing your books to people and saying, this is what it looks like to have courage. This is what it looks like to be a mother in the world. This is what, I mean, I think we need to become mothers to know the mother. And to become a mother is to be able, mothers can, you know, clean up our messes. They can wipe our bottoms. They can clean up our puke. They don't get grossed out. Yeah. You know, they make sandwiches and they find food when there isn't food, and they work it out. And I think all of us need to have the courage and the compassion of mothers who get so dismissed in our culture.
You know, in the last section of the book, The Queen of Heaven and Earth, it begins with Perdita recounting our trip to the Dordogne River Valley to see the painted caves, see the places where some of these oldest black Madonnas still exist and where some of the earliest goddess figurines had been discovered. And we really wanted to sort of trace, you know, the rosary back to its origins with this figure, this great mother. And, you know, the rosary itself goes in a circle, and the book sort of goes in a circle too. There are three basic parts to the rosary. Like, it tells a story over 15 mysteries, and there are joyful mysteries, there are sorrowful mysteries, and there are glorious mysteries. And a few years ago, right about the time we were traveling to France, I began to think of the 15 mysteries of the rosary as basically kind of a history of our species. The joyful mysteries are this long, slow paradise of the Paleolithic, when people basically lived in harmony with the land and with one another. And these correspond to the mysteries of the Annunciation, where, you know, Mary discovers she's pregnant. She gives birth to her child in a stable and puts him in a manger, which is basically a food trough for animals, right? It's ecological symbol par excellence. And then goes through his young adulthood, right about the time of his he's being welcomed into the Jewish faith at age 12. Then the sorrowful mysteries all take place in a 24-hour period. And I think of those as basically in our evolutionary history as like the last 12,000 years. It's just an eye blank what's happened to us, you know, in the context of our longer evolutionary history. But it's a decisive moment. Jesus is arrested. He is tortured. He is humiliated.
It's really the evils of empire and all of it. You know, this is what empire does. Yeah. Empire takes life and murders it.
Right.
All life.
Yeah. Nails it to the cross. We've been doing it for 12,000 years. But then it doesn't end there. The rosary doesn't end there. Then there's the resurrection. Now, this is not a religious article of faith for us. I mean, in nature, resurrection is not the exceptional event. This is not something that happened to Jesus. This is something that's happening all around us all the time.
Oh, so I want to tell a quick story, if that's okay.
Please.
Yeah, sure.
So when I was raised a fundamentalist Christian, mm-hmm. and I remember when I was about 7 or 8, I got what I like to call the wrong end of the logical stick, which is that it occurred to me that that nature is based on death and rebirth. You know, the grasshoppers would die in the fall, and then new ones would come in the spring.
Right.
And the grass has seed. I mean, I understood. It's like I suddenly got the idea of death and rebirth.
Right.
Okay, you with me so far?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at 7 years old, I thought, isn't that cool that nature is based on the story of Jesus?
yeah, right. You were onto something. I'm sure you got scolded for that.
Oh, no, because I was a fundamentalist Christian. Everybody thought it was a great idea. Oh,
yeah, okay. But the centrality is that Jesus is at the center instead of nature.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I had it backwards. That I got the connection, but I had the logic all wrong.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
But, in truth, in those early Mediterranean mystery cults, they were just watching the cycles of nature.
Right.
And these mysteries of the rosary were an attempt by people under the oppressive empire of Christianity to maintain the wisdom of those mystery cults.
Yeah. So during the Middle Ages, when the rosary was taking shape, the priests wanted the rosary to mimic the storyline of the New Testament, or basically of the Bible, right? Bible begins with a sinful woman, you know, bringing suffering on all humankind, and it ends with apocalypse, with the end of the world. That's a linear storyline, if there ever was one. But medieval people rejected that idea, and they came up with a solution to it, which is that at the end of the rosary, rather than ending it with the last judgment, as the priest wanted, they ended the rosary with the crowning of Mary as Queen of Heaven and Earth. And if you look at medieval art depicting Mary as the Queen of Heaven, it's really interesting because she should be about 72 years old at that point, the point of her death when she's assumed into heaven. But she's invariably portrayed as very, very young. Oftentimes she's with a young Jesus, as if they were bride and groom. And in other portraits, she's shown young and holding the infant Jesus, so that the rosary basically circles back to where it began. So it forms a circle, not a line, and circles are redemptive, just as the planetary ecology is a redemptive cycle, as you yourself knew, your seven-year-old self.
Well, thank you so much, Father. We're pretty close to out of time. Is there anything else you want to say about your wonderful book, A Wonderful Work?
Oh, well, just, Derek, that we're so grateful to you and for your work, that our book exists thanks to everything you've written and thought about. You know, really does. I mean, Clark and I still think about that moment, first coming upon your writing at that wonderful bookstore in Brattleboro and just going, my gosh, this is who we've been looking for. This is what we've been thinking and feeling, and somebody is articulating it at last. And so we really just are so, so grateful for all you do in the world.
The only other thing I'll add is that we have an online rosary fellowship called The Way of the Rose on Facebook, where you have a lot of fans. And it's an amazing thing because, you know, it's not a religious group. It's not certainly not a Catholic group. There are a lot of people who are ecologically woke, you know, a lot of people who really have their eyes
are
trying to be, who share their art and their stories. And your name comes up a lot. So we're very grateful to that.
Well, thank you for the admiration. This is a mutual admiration society here because I have such respect for both of you. Anyway, I would like to thank you so much for being on the program. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guests today have been Clark Strand and Perdita Finn. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.